This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على رسول الكريم وعلى آله وصحبه ومن استنى بسنة يوم الدين. All praise is due to Allah and may Allah's peace and blessings be on the last Prophet Muhammad صلى الله عليه وسلم and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. In our previous session, we looked at verses 83 to verses 88, where the story of Dhulqarnain began. We began talking about Dhulqarnain himself. Who was he? We clarified that he wasn't Alexander the Great, though a number of commentators felt so, like Fakhruddin al-Razi. As we said in the previous session, we began to look at the story of Dhulqarnain, clarifying that he wasn't Alexander the Great, though some scholars of the past felt so. And we said basically the reason why he wasn't acceptable was because of the fact that though historically he was the individual known to have conquered lands to the west and to the east, he was himself a worshipper of idols. He belonged to Greek society and the Greek belief system, which contradicts the descriptions of Dhulqarnain in the Quran itself. Dhulqarnain is described there as one who believes in the one God, so much so that some scholars felt that Dhulqarnain was a prophet of Allah. There are some narrations of questionable authenticity where Prophet Muhammad ﷺ was asked about Dhulqarnain.
West Africa. that's where we start. We start a new Atlantic Ocean. However, we said it is also possible, you know, based on recent research, that we may have gone to America. And that's where we start. Because after that now is the Pacific. What is between there and the next major landfall, that's across to China, which represents the farthest point east. So that could just as well have been also. And we talked about him being to the farthest point east. No, that's as far as we got. We got us to the farthest point west. And how he would deal and treat those people that he met there, those who conquered. Those who accepted the call to the worship of Allah, he would treat them gently, and he affirmed that their reward would be with Allah. Whereas those who rejected his call to the worship of Allah alone, that those would be punished. He would punish them, and furthermore, they would be punished by Allah in the next life. We discussed about some issues regarding it. So from there, we are now continuing on verses 89 and 90. ثم أتبع سببا حتى إذا بلغ مطلع الشمس وجدها تطبع على قوم لم نجعل لهم دونها سترا. Then he followed another way until when he reached the sunrise, he found it rising on a people for whom I had not provided any shield against it. Then he followed another way until when he reached the sunrise. And I told us that Dhul-Qarnayn then traveled from the farthest point west on the earth towards the farthest point east. The east and the west are mentioned, but not the north and the south. Why is that? Somebody might ask. Because the major civilizations of the earth tend to be across the middle of the earth, east and west. If you look at all of the major ancient civilizations, whether it's in Egypt, whether it's in Mesopotamia, in China, etc., all of the major civilizations tend to be close to the equator, to the east and to the west. But the way to the farthest parts, north and south, where do you end up? You end up in the North Pole, which is ice. Nobody living there, and one of them is South Pole, which is ice, nobody living there either. So, logically, the major journeys that you would undertake on the earth would be to the east and to the west. And this is a point, you know, which we can see even in some statements of the Prophet ﷺ, as in a narration which was reported by Faydan, in which he quoted Prophet Muhammad ﷺ as saying, indeed Allah has laid up the earth for me, and I saw its east and its west. Indeed, the dominion of my nation will reach as far as what was laid up for me. So, even in this hadith, Prophet ﷺ speaks about the east and the west. And as you said, north and south, these are areas which are basically uninhabitable. I mean, modern science has put people there to do research, etc., but nobody makes their homes there. Even the Eskimos were a little bit south of the North Pole. Now, whenever Dhul-Qarnayn in his march to the east, whenever he came across a nation, he conquered them and invited them to the worship of Allah alone, as he did on his way west. If they obeyed him, he treated them honorably and gave them status. Otherwise, he would humiliate them and take their wealth and possessions. For every defeated nation, he would take what his armies needed to fight the next nation. When he reached the place where the sun rises, as Allah said, وجدها تطلع على قوم لم نجعل لهم دونها سترا. He found it rising on a people for whom I had not provided any shield against it. They have neither houses nor clothing. They are barefoot and naked. Qatada, student of Ibn Abbas, he had said that they had no caves or homes to protect them from the sun, because buildings would not remain steady in their land, So they lived in underground caverns. Some of the early commentators stated that this referred to the Zenj, people of East Africa, that were now known as Zanzibar, because they originally from Zanzibar. Some of the used to walk around virtually naked. However, this is speculation. We don't know that to be the case. In fact, in that part of the world, people do live in homes, etc., and they have a lot to shade them from the sun. At any rate, Allah goes on to say in verse 91, كَذَٰلِكَ وَقَدْ أَخَفْنَا بِمَا لَدَيْهِ خَبْرًا. He left them as they were, and I completely knew everything about them. There is no detail as to what Dhul-Qarnayn did with these people. The phrase, كَذَٰلِكَ, like that, or in that way, could mean he left them as they were, or it could mean the sun rose on a people similar to those whom it had set upon, and Dhul-Qarnayn treated them as he treated those in the far west, with respect to punishing the disbelieving wrongdoers and rewarding the righteous believers. In the very beginning, Allah said he was not going to give the whole story, but just give something of the story. وَقَدْ أَخَفْنَا بِمَا لَدَيْهِ خِبْرًا. And I completely knew everything about him. Mujahid al-Masudi said, this means that Allah knew everything about Dhul-Qarnayn and his army, and nothing else he knew from him, even though they came from so many different nations and lands. For as Allah said in Surah Ali Imran, verse 5, إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَخْفَى عَلَيْهِ شَيْءٍ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا فِي السَّمَاءِ. Truly nothing is hidden from Allah in the earth or in the heavens. Verses 92 and 93. ثُمَّ أَتْبَعَ سَبَبًا حَتَّى إِذَا بَلَغَ بَيْنَ السَّدَّيْنِ وَجَدَ مِنْ دُونِهِمَا قَوْمًا لَا يَكَادُونَ يَفْقَهُونَ قَوْلًا. Then he followed yet another way until he reached a path between two great mountains, at the foot of which he found a people who scarcely understood a word. ثُمَّ أَتْبَعَ سَبَبًا. Then he followed yet another way, opposite to the east and the west, meaning that he traveled in the direction of the north, not heading to the north pole, but heading perpendicular to what he was going. حَتَّى إِذَا بَلَغَ بَيْنَ السَّدَّيْنِ. Until he reached the path between two great mountains, meaning that he followed a third path north until he reached a valley between two enormous mountains. وَجَدَ مِنْ دُونِهِمَا قَوْمًا لَا يَكَادُونَ يَفْقَهُونَ قَوْلًا. And the Almighty explained that at the foot of the mountains he found a nation of people who scarcely understood a word. Some scholars know that the location of this nation was behind the two mountains, while others were within the valley in front of the two mountains. The word يَفْقَهُونَ on this plan could also be recited as يُفْقَهُونَ, to make others understand, according to the recitation of Hamza and Al-Kasai. Together, the two recitations indicate that they could neither understand what others said, nor could others understand what they said. The Qarnayn and his people had great difficulty in understanding their speech, because their language was strange, and this nation had probably been isolated from other people for a long period of time. قالوا يا ذا القرنين إن يأجوج ومأجوج مفسدون في الأرض فهل نجعل لك خرجا أو خرجا على أن تجعل بيننا وبينهم سدا. They said, Dhul-Qarnayn, truly the God and the low God people are corrupting the land. Can you pay me tribute to erect a barrier between them and us? قالوا يا ذا القرنين. They said, O Dhul-Qarnayn. Scholars of Tafsir surmise that Dhul-Qarnayn's ability to understand their speech was among the means bestowed on him by Allah, as Allah gave the ability to understand the speech of ants to Prophet Sulaiman. He could have given the ability to understand their speech there as well. How hardly intelligible to most people, it was more intelligible to him. Or some of them explain that this was said to their translators, right? They said this to translators amongst them who then translated into the language of Zulqarnain and his people. إِنَّ يَأْجُودَ وَمَأْجُودَ مُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ. Truly the God and the Magog are corrupting the land. The God and the Magog. In Arabic, يَأْجُود وَمَأْجُوج. They are nations of human beings from among the progeny of Adam, peace be upon him, as stated by the Prophet ﷺ in the following narration from Abu Sa'id al-Khudri. Allah would say, O Adam, Adam will respond, here I am happily at your service, and all good is in your hands. Allah will then say, send forth the group of the hellfire. Adam will ask, what is the group of the hellfire? Allah will reply, 999 out of every thousand. That time, the hair of young children will turn gray. Every pregnant woman will drop below. And people will appear drunk, but they won't be drunk, because Allah's punishment is severe. The companions asked, which one of us will be the one? The one out of the thousand. He replied, good news for all of you. It will be one person from among you, and 1,000 from among the gods and the Magog. Then he said, by the one whose hand my soul lies, I'm hoping that you will be 1/4 of the people of paradise. We exclaimed, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. The Prophet also gave a vivid description of the physical appearance of the gods and the Magog. There are many stories that you can read about, but there are mostly fables describing them as being only a palm's width height, you know, like Tale of the Two Cities or whatever, you know, like little people, right? But they're only so high. Some say they're huge, tall. There are all kinds of stories about them, but most of this is fables and fabricated information. What does that come to? Inshallah, I'm with you. Description of them, Harmala narrated from his maternal aunt that Allah's messenger gave a sermon while his finger was bandaged from a scorpion's sting. In the sermon he said, indeed, you say that there are no more enemies. After Mecca was conquered, then the Sahaba felt, you know, finish. No more enemies. You know, we have defeated idolatry. Islam is established. Now, there are no more enemies. Prophet ﷺ said, this is what you say. However, you will surely continue fighting enemies until the God and the Magog come. With broad faces, small eyes, white hair on the tops of their heads, swarming from every direction, as if their faces were shields covered with skin. Broad faces, small eyes, white hair on the tops of their heads, swarming from every direction, as if their faces were shields covered with skin. This description, the Prophet means to describe the Turks. He said, in another narration, narrated by Abu Huraira, the last hour will not come before you fight the Turks. Fight the Turks, who have small faces, or small eyes, red faces, short noses, whose faces look as though they were shielded covered with skin. And before you fight the people whose sandals are made of hair. The last hour will not come before you fight the Turks, who have small eyes, red faces. Red actually turned that they use red, it means really white. In Arabic, when they lose
red to describe the color of the skin, they use it means light, very light. Short noses, that's white, where a person, their complexion becomes what they call ruddy, light which tends towards red. Short noses, their face is lifted as if they were shield covered with skin. That's how you describe the Turks. So because of the similarity of description, some Quranic commentators felt that they must have been the Mongols. The Mongols who came, and the Turks intermarried with some of them, etc. During the time of Genghis Khan, who came from Mongolia, and they came out of Mongolia like a wave of destruction. They took the Muslim world and destroyed it, you know, through Tunis, all the way to Baghdad, annihilating people left and right, massacring people to the point where the rivers and the streets of the cities were flowing with blood. They piled skulls on top of each other, making mounds, mountains of skulls, people's heads that were chopped off. So they were really a scourge. So, looking at them, some commentators said that this must have been the Gog and the Magog. However, if we look at the description which Prophet gave of them in terms of the accounts that would take place, the incidents that would happen around them, we know that they weren't the Gog and the Magog. But it's enough that the description is similar to the Turks to let us know that they were human beings and not little, you know, midget people, you know, dwarfs, or, you know, people think they are some kind of, you know, other creatures. And they even have some narrations which claim that they were made from, you know, other sources. They were not descendants of Adam at all. So, describing them as having claws, like animal claws, you know, kinds of, you know, weird stuff. But this is not the case. The basic descriptions of them match the descriptions of other human beings. Descriptions of the Gog and the Magog in Jewish and Christian literature are often contradictory. Consequently, there's no clear picture of exactly who they were. Gog in the Bible is a hostile power ruled by Satan that will manifest itself immediately before the end of the world. That's in Revelation 20. In the biblical passage in Revelation, in another Christian and Jewish apocalyptic literature, God is joined by a second hostile force, Magog. But elsewhere in Ezekiel 38 and Genesis 10 verse 2, Magog is apparently the origin of God's origin. It's the place of God's origin. The Bible also refers to Magog as the second son of Japheth, between Gomer and Madai. But in the list of nations in Genesis 10, the term connotes the barbarian people dwelling to the extreme north, in the northeast of the earth. And in Ezekiel 39 verse 6, the Magog is referred to as a modern people, the leader of whom is God. According to the Jewish Encyclopedia article, Gog and Magog, both of us in the ancient Jewish historians identified them as the Scythians, a name referring to a number of unknown ferocious tribes. According to Jerome, Magog was situated between the Caucasus and the Caspian Sea. So in Jewish Christian literature, they don't really have a very clear picture. It's very, you know, vague, and their statements about the Gog and the Magog are quite contradictory. Some places they say they're nations, some places they say they're individuals, etc. The people complained to Bill Cornelian about Gog and the Magog, saying, indeed, the Gog and the Magog people are corrupting the land. Scholars differ as to the nature of their corruption. Some say they ate human beings. Others said it referred to oppression, murder, and other forms of corruption. Yet others said they completely consumed the crops of neighboring nations. All of these descriptions, except for the first, can be found in the prophecy about their destructive acts during the period, their period of world domination. فَهَلْ نَجْعَلُ لَكَ خَرْجًا عَلَىٰ أَن تَجْعَلَ بَيْنَنَا وَبَيْنَهُمْ سَدًّا. After explaining their situation, people respectfully requested Zulkarnain's help, saying, can we pay you tribute to erect a barrier between them and us? They requested that he build a wall to separate them and protect them from the evil acts of the god and the no-god. They offered in return some of their wealth in order to ensure his health, not because they thought that a ruler who had already conquered the east and west needed it. Imam al-Qurtubi, the Spanish scholar of the 12th century, identified a particular benefit which can be extracted from this verse. He said, this verse contains evidence for the establishment of prisons. And the incarceration of the corrupt and preventing them from acting as they wish and not leaving them to do whatever they're doing. Instead, they should be beaten and imprisoned or fined and freed, as Umar ibn al-Khattab did. There were no prisons during the era of Prophethood. Prophet didn't have any prisons. People were sometimes in prison but in their homes. They didn't have particular institutions dedicated to just holding prisoners per se. And similarly in the time of Abu Bakr, there had no prisons. So it was in the time of Umar ibn al-Khattab that he made the actually had to establish prisons. But proof can be deduced from this verse, because the people are asking Dhul-Qarnayn basically to make a prison to hold the gods and the no-god back from their destruction of neighboring lands. فَلَمَا مَكَّنَّي فِيهِ رَبِّي خَيْرٌ فَأَعِينُونِي بِقُوَّةٍ أَجْعَلْ بَيْنَكُمْ وَبَيْنَهُمْ رَدْمًا. He replied, the way in which my Lord has established me is far better. Assist me with manpower and I will erect a strong barrier between you and them. Dhul-Qarnayn being a righteous individual and knowing that Allah had a better reward for him if he had them, refused to be paid. The Almighty quoted to him, all of my makkani fi rabbi khayr. He replied, the way in which my Lord has established me is far better. Meaning that the power and authority which Allah has given me is better for me than what you have collected. The statement is like that of Prophet Sulaiman, peace be upon him, when presents were brought to him from Queen Bilqis. His response was, will you help me in wealth that Allah has given me is better than what he has given you? أتنبونني بمال فما آتاني الله خير مما آتاكم بل أنتم بهديتكم تفرحون. That's Surah An-Naml, verse 36. فأعلموني بقوة أجعل بينكم وبينهم ردما. Instead, Dhul-Qarnayn just asked for some men to help him build a wall even bigger than what they requested, saying, assist me with manpower, and I will erect a strong barrier between you and them. Really, that the idea that the barrier that he offered to erect was even bigger, is because they asked him to be for them sadda, which means a barrier. But he offered to be radma, which means a barrier made by piling things on top of one another. So it implied a stronger barrier even than what they requested. And from this, again, Imam al-Qurtubi, he suggested that this verse contains proof that it is obligatory on rulers to protect their subjects' lives, repair damage to their property, and guard their rights and their wealth, even if his own wealth is consumed in fulfilling their rights and providing aid to them. However, his subject should replace his losses from their wealth where needed. He should also give them the benefit of the doubt in his dealings with them. Aid should be given according to three conditions. One, he should not favor some of his subjects over others. Two, he should begin by aiding the neediest first, then the needy. Three, he should spend on them equally or equitably according to their situations. When Zulqarnain was offered money to prevent the attacks of the Gog and the Magog, which he feared, he informed the people that the wealth he had was sufficient, and what he needed instead was their manpower. He could see that their wealth was barely sufficient for their own needs, so if he took wages, it would reduce what they needed from him, what he needed from them, and the reward would go to them because they paid him for what he did. Thus, he concluded that voluntary manpower was more appropriate. The main guideline to be followed in these matters is that no one's wealth can be legitimately consumed unless a real necessity exists. If the debt exists, then such wealth should be taken openly and not secretly, and spent fairly and not preferentially, and it should be done according to the opinion of the community and not unilaterally. أعطيني جبر الحديد حتى إذا ساوى بين الصدفين قال انفخوا حتى إذا جعله نارا قال أعطيني افرغ عليه قطرا. So bring me blocks of iron. When you left them, he leveled off the gap between the two mountain faces. He instructed blow on it until he made it red and made it fire red. Then he said, bring me molten copper to pour over it. أعطيني جبر الحديد حتى إذا ساوى بين الصدفين. So bring me blocks of iron. When he had leveled off the gap between the two mountain faces, Zulqarnain had them pile up blocks of iron, one on top of each other, until he reached a wall stretching from one side of the valley. Until he created a wall stretching from one side of the valley to the other, linking the faces of the two mountains. I don't know if you can picture that. Right? He came to an area between two mountains. The two mountains, we say like this, these are the faces of the two mountains. So he filled up from the middle, built upwards and outwards until he linked the two mountains basically with the wall. Right? And a wall of iron blocks. And of course they're doing these kind of things now. In those times, of course it would seem amazing. How could they possibly do it? It's like building the pyramids. A massive structure. And this is being done out of iron. قال انفخوا حتى إذا جعله نارا. He instructed them, blow on it until he made it fire red. And he said, bring me molten copper to pour over it. Once the wall was complete, fires were lit beside the wall and bellows were used to blow air from the fire onto the wall until it became red hot. قال أعطوني افرغ عليه قطرا. And he said, bring me molten copper to pour over it. He instructed them to pour molten copper over the superheated wall, coating it and blending with it, turning it into a solid single structure. Ibn Jarir narrated from Qatada that a man informed Allah's Messenger that he had seen the wall of Gog and Magog. And he asked him, Fazatalam asked him, describe it for me. The man replied, it is like an ink-colored cloak with black and red stripes. The Prophet said, you have seen it. Muslim historical records mention that in the 9th century, during the reign of the Abbasid Caliph Al-Wafiq, an expedition was dispatched to search and identify the locality of Zulqarnain's wall in Central Asia. They traveled from country to country, from kingdom to kingdom, until they found it, and saw its structure made of iron and copper. They mentioned that they saw in the wall a huge bill with massive blocks. They also saw some leftover building blocks and a tower from the original building of the wall. Al-Wafiq's emissaries also saw sentries guarding the wall from the neighboring kingdom. The wall was impregnable and incredibly tall. They returned home after a period of 2 years. They were 2 years out searching for this wall. فَمَسْتَعُوا أَنْ يَبْهَرُوهُ وَمَسْتَطَاعُوا لَهُ مَقْدَرُ. So they were unable, verse 97, they were unable to climb over it or tunnel through it. So they are unable to climb over it or tunnel through it. The Gargamelo Dam, they are unable to scale it because it is too high and too smooth. Nor were they able to bore through it because it is too solid. In the first case, the verb istau, and in the second case, istatau was used. They are synonyms, the first being only a contractive form and the second. The additional letters in the second form indicate greater difficulty than in the first, which is the case in fact. To bear through the wall was much more difficult than to climb over it or over the mountains. The name of bin Jahsh related to the Prophet ﷺ came to her in a distressed state saying, "There is no God worthy of worship but Allah. Woe to the Arabs from the great evil that has approached them. Today a hole has been opened in the dam of the God and the Magog, like this, and made a circle between his thumb and his forefinger." Zainab asked him, "O Messenger of Allah, shall he be destroyed even though there are righteous people among us?" He replied, "Yes, if wickedness becomes prevalent." A question, "Shall he be destroyed even though there are righteous people among us?" His answer was, "Yes, if wickedness becomes prevalent." This is Hadith number 5. This is the part of the general one which Allah gives in the Quran. وَاتَّقُوا فِتْنَةً لَا تُصِيبَنَّ الَّذِينَ ظَلَمُوا مِنْكُمْ خَاصَّةً وَاعْلَمُوا أَنَّ اللَّهَ شَدِيدُ الْعِقَابِ. And fear the affliction, which does not affect only those of you who belong, and know that Allah is severe in punishment. Another dua of the believers are told to choose their companions carefully and to avoid places of corruption. But when Zafallah had said, "Al-mar'u ala dhimmi khalili, falyanbur ahadukum man yukhalil." Man follows the religion of his friends. So each of you should be careful about who he takes for a friend. So, this is the trial as we begin today, next week, we will continue with the final details about the God and the Magog, exploring to issues of the last day, signs of the last hour. Sufficient for us to recap what we have covered so far, that in the case of the Qarnayn's journey to the east, he treated the people there basically as he treated them in the west. Well, I didn't go into descriptions as to how he treated them and what took place, etc. He just said Kavalik in the same way, in a similar way. Who those people were, we don't know. Just as we don't know who the people in the west were. It was just enough that Allah told us that he went to the farthest point west, as he east after going to the farthest point west. And we said that Allah mentioned the east and the west rather than the north and the south. Why? Yeah, because basically people are not inhabiting the north and the south. Farthest north and farthest south are the poles. And then he left them and set out on another journey, which was towards the north, until he reached the place where the nation that was in direct contact with the God and the Magog were. And they requested him there to build a wall to protect them from the Gog and the Magog. We said that the Gog and the Magog were human beings from the descendants of Adam, and we also pointed out that there is some similarity between how they look and how the Turks looked. Right? The Turks, this term really referring to the people, of northern areas of what is called Turkmenistan, which is a mixture of the people of the Mongols and the people of that region. And he said that the gods and the new gods were not the Mongols, as some people mistakenly understood. So, Will Kamloon built this wall, and with the assistance of the people, established a means to protect them from the harm of the God and the Magog. One question remains, commonly asked by Orientalists. They say, if Will Kamloon made this massive wall, we have sent satellites all over the earth. We have mapped one corner from the one corner of the earth to the other. We've got this shuttle going around the earth all the time. You can look down from the satellites and see, you know, they have spy satellites, satellites of Jamaica and Greece, for example. You know, where they come from that satellite, you know, see things the size of a football. From the satellite up in space, they can see objects the size of a football. So, if you've been all over the earth, where is this wall? Good question. Why have we seen it? To refer to the table. It's a big challenge because, of course, Allah said that the stories he tells in the Quran are true. I mentioned to you in the beginning we talked about stories in the Quran, you know, way back. We talked about the fact that Allah in Surah Yusuf and elsewhere refers to the various stories that he narrates as being the truth. It's the difference between divinely revealed stories and stories that we write. We make up stories, fictional stories, etc., etc. You know, though the end may be similar, we don't have the kind of information about the real world that we can find sufficient information, so we make up information. Whereas Allah doesn't need that. He can deal and give all the information he needs to give us in stories using true stories. So, if we get true stories, where is the world of the coming? Yeah, that's another question. But let's deal with this bigger question right now. The bigger question right now, the other question I've got to raise was also why it is that history, the historical records, have lost information about this great king, conqueror, Will Kamloon. Why don't we have records talking about him? We have about Alexander the Great. Of course, if you are among those who say that he was Alexander the Great, come with it. But now let's go back to the issue of the wall. Where is that wall? What do we say? How do we explain the fact that we can't see it? Anybody have any ideas? Okay, that is saying that Allah does wish for it to be revealed at this time. When the time comes, we will make it visible to people. Iron oxidizes.
Should
we
know something like
that?
Just
to find
iron
or
anything,
it will
become
oxidized. Well, they said it was covered by copper. You know, completely covered by molten copper, and that would protect it from oxidization. So where is the wall? Well, reality. Has Western science, geologists, etc., covered every square inch of this world? They haven't. Not only that, they are digging up in places where they thought they knew everything, they're still digging up regions. They're still digging up other temples. And so there are things which may be covered by sand maybe covered by vegetation, maybe covered by a variety of different snow, maybe covered by a variety of different elements, which make it not readily visible. It's quite possible. You don't know every square inch of the earth. That's reality. So we don't, we use the argument, we say to them, Adam will only be shown, both will be only. No, they say the tree falls, right? In an environment where there's nobody to hear the tree, will you make a sound? We don't have to be there to hear the sound for the sound to exist. There is objective reality out there. So the fact that you can't see the wall doesn't mean there is no wall. It just means, as you said, Allah has not made it visible to people at this point in time. Simple enough. When the time comes, it will be. Similarly with Dhulqarnain name in history, why is his name not appear in history? Well, if we follow Western research, are they not discovering about people who they didn't know about 50, 20, 50 years ago? They're discovering people who played major roles in different parts of the earth who they didn't know about. So simply because of one of the fact that we don't have him clearly identified in the record, he may have been from an earlier period where they weren't keeping records. You know, who's to say he was in the time, you know, similar to that of Alexander the Great, where they did keep records? Who's not to say he was from a period before that? Question specifically concerning the hole in the wall, which Prophet ﷺ had mentioned concerning the God and the no God, that a hole the size of the circle that he made between his thumb and forefinger had appeared in the wall. And that was in the time of the Prophet ﷺ, 1,400 years ago. So the sister's question was, is that the opening for them to come to? Well, if it was, they would have been warm, then they would grab already. So you know, it wasn't. And we will go back to when we start to look at the other incidents concerning them and how the world eventually is destroyed and how they come over the earth and what happens in their time and, you know, who's around at that time, what happens, the slaughters that they did and, you know, the challenges that they made and how they eventually defeated. In that time, we will also look at the issue of the hole in the wall.
We will bring some
data.
It's not actually a real hole. We will bring some
data
to the
right.
This hole in the wall.
Well, they're suggesting that maybe this is metaphorical, a metaphorical hole in the wall. No, we don't need to go there. Prophet said, a hole has appeared in the wall like this. Right? He didn't say a metaphorical hole has appeared in the wall. You know, there's a hole in the wall. He made with his finger to show what that hole is like, what is the size of that hole. So after that, we don't go and say, well, maybe it's metaphorical. Right? We stay with it. There are other hadiths which clarify about the hole and how the hole is actually closed up. It appears, but it becomes closed up. I've given out the secret. End the discussion about that. We will look at it in further detail next Friday. Further question? Okay, inshallah, then we'll stop here. We are early today. And what I'd just like to mention that tomorrow's Aqidah class, for those of you that are coming to the Aqidah class of Sheikh Abdul Rauf, you know, I will be taking it over as he is not available, he's outside the country, and he will be for some time. So I will be taking over the class myself tomorrow. So you're invited, those of you who are not attending normally, you are welcome to come and join that class. Further point I'd just like to mention, you
know, we have reached now basically verse 95, meaning that there is basically another 15 verses remaining, and we will complete the surah. Two things. One, I was considering giving an examination, right, for the study of Surah Al-Kahf. Now, I know many of you are taking notes, so that really puts you in a bind. Well, I have been preparing the notes all along, so once we're finished, the notes will then be put together and made available in the complete form. But before doing that, I wanted a few volunteers who have good command of English to read some sections of it, just to make sure to remove typos and these kind of things, so it reads smoothly for everybody. So I need, if I'm on the women's side, if the sisters can give their names, I need about four or five readers from the women's side, and similarly from the men's side. If you can give your names, we have the attendance sheet. If you can just make a note that you are willing to read some sections, I won't give you, don't expect to read the whole thing. We'll just give you some sections divided up amongst you, and just to help get through it quickly so we can make it available as soon as possible. But what I'm saying is that we're going to start doing that from now. I won't wait until we complete and then give it to you, because of course then time is going to be short. So from now I'll put together what we have covered so far and then start to divide it up for some of you who could volunteer to do some reading for me. Any further questions? And you can start thinking about what is the next surah that you'd like for us to cover also. Assalamu alaikum. Just a point of note that Abdul Aouf's class is actually in the review section preparing for an exam. So I'm just going through the review with him. There's still a point you can still benefit from the information of the class. But obviously you will not be prepared to take any kind of examination. It's mainly for those who have been taking the class all along. But still, the issues that are treated that are covered are valid and useful issues, and they focus on signs of the Day of Judgment. So, if you have any other questions, we will close, and those who would like to volunteer to do some reading, they can just stay back and take your names and contact numbers so that, inshallah, we can pass the information across to you. Subhanakallahumma bihamdika, inshallah, Allah ilaha illa ant, astaghfiruka wa atubu ilayk. Also, the attendance sheet, where is it, please? Stop to somebody. Anybody who hasn't signed in, tip themselves off, please just do so.